They call it the fourth grade slump. It's that moment sometime in the middle grade years when school kids start to pay more attention to what other people think of them and how what they do or say might be perceived. It's probably helpful in getting them to stop picking their noses once and for all, but it also takes a toll on their creativity. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Some of us never quite recover from the fourth grade slump. Forever after, we feel silly drawing a flower with plaid leaves or hanging out in a backyard fort imagining we're pirates. Somebody might think we're weird. But those who do come back from the slump to lead the most creative lives have something in common. They recognize the innate human ability to dream up new ideas, and they are not afraid to engage it. Matt Richtel is a Pulitzer Prize-winning science reporter for The New York Times. His newest book is called Inspired, Understanding Creativity, A Journey Through Art, Science, and the Soul. Matt, welcome back to Think.
Thank you, Chris. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Good.
I feel blessed to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, I think we all feel that way.
After. I think I said it twice.
Yeah.
I'm redundant. How are you?
I'm...
So, that's a joke.
I
saw what I was doing.
You are right on top of things. All right, let's get to the conversation here, because I know you've got books to talk about. It's helpful to creativity if we have access to lots of different kinds of information, right? Obtained through education or travel or experience. But creativity is not just about being smart. What do we need to understand about the difference between intelligence and creativity?
Yeah. So many misconceptions I had when I started. I think one of them was I held a vision of a isolated creative genius, possibly misanthropic. none of which is necessarily true. And the genius part in particular, I'll start with a study. Researchers looked at the relationship between IQ and creativity, and I cite this study with an asterisk, Chris, because IQ is not the best measure of intellect, but it's the one that was used for a long time. If you have an intellect or measured by IQ as between 100 and 120, which is essentially average, you have enough to be a highly, highly creative person. And interestingly, if you have an IQ above 145, 147, you may actually see limitations to your creativity. So the relationship between intelligence as measured by IQ and creativity is modest.
So we talked about IQ as something that was used to measure intelligence, whether completely accurately or not. How do you measure creativity? Is there even an accepted scientific definition?
I looked at a lot of definitions. There are two that make the most sense to me after studying this for a while. One I'll put in my tongue and the other I'll put in Einstein's. I think it is something that is novel and has impact. And I want to explain those terms. Novel can be something new and it doesn't have to be hugely new. But more importantly, impact doesn't mean changing the world. And this is a vital component of understanding creativity. We tend to think of creativity as associated with fame, fortune, and significant change. But every change that we understand over time that looks big was built on the shoulders of many smaller changes that came before. So do not mistake or conflate big change with creativity. I'll also give you Einstein's definition of creativity because he's Einstein and it's awesome. He called it intelligence having fun.
So you actually write about four different levels of creativity, the mini C, the little C, the pro C, and the big C. What do each of those C's represent?
Yeah, I get them out of order. Give them to me one more time. I know what they mean. It's the mini C.
Mini C, little C, pro C, big C. I feel like I'm about to start
you.
A
okay.
Dr. Seuss book.
It's the pro C and the big C that I get confused. Look. You go into your kitchen, Chris, and you got two hungry kids and you got three seasonings left and a piece of chicken. You figure out dinner. I maybe we should call this the big C. It's the hardest one. But it's the one where someone could lose their lives. But that's a mini C. You created something. Don't underestimate that that has a creative component to it. In fact, later on, I can link that directly to the bacterial the biological level. There might be a small C beyond that where you've made some contributions at work. You've actually gone and created a recipe, a formal recipe, and you've handed it out to your friends. And they've handed out to their friends. I don't know if you had this experience during COVID, but were you part of the thing where somebody gave you a sourdough bread? Did you hear about that, where
I
people
have
were handing
enough,
out?
yeah, I have enough to keep alive, so I didn't get on the sourdough bandwagon, but I've always baked regular bread.
Okay, so look, you're doing something consistently. You may have added a twist to it. You may have passed that around to someone. That's a little C. The pro C is a really interesting one, and it's really interesting to try to distinguish it from the big C. Chris, you and I essentially do pro Cs. We have jobs in which we are making modest contributions or occasionally a more significant contribution. I've had books that have flopped, and I've had books that have been named books of the year. And that's a pro C. I'm seasoned at what I do, and I do it well. I'm going to distinguish that from the big C, and then I want to show where that gets murky. The big C are the ones that are going to transcend eras, and they are few and far between. They might be the Einsteins, the Picassos. In this book, I can be sure of one that I interviewed. His name is James Allison, and he came up with immunotherapy and won a Nobel Prize for science. It is a big C. It changed lives and will transcend an era. But here's where it gets tricky, Chris. What about Yo-Yo Ma, who I talked to in this book? What about Steve Kerr, the Warriors coach? What about Judd Apatow, who I, the wonderful comedic director who I talked about, or David Milch, who I talked to, who created Hill Street Blues, and what's the incredible show set in the Western in South Dakota, North Dakota.
Oh, Yellowstone?
Shucks, the name escapes the show escapes me. What about those people? And this is where it gets murky. In some ways, they're at the highest level of pro Cs, and some of their creations may transcend, but I don't know that we'll remember them 100 years from now.
So, what stands out to you about the life and temperament of someone like Yo-Yo Ma, the cellist, who maybe let's agree that he's somewhere between Pro C and Big C. What is sort of special about the way he approaches life?
Well, I want to start with an anecdote. I got a chance to spend some time talking to him, and but the thing that stood out most to me is I watched a concert he did, and I watched his, not his fingers, but his face. And it was like a topographical map of his soul. His lips quavered, and then his eyes moved, and his chin, and then his there were nuances of fear and love and connection, and he wore his emotions outside for us and allowed his authenticity to marry his talent. And I think what you see about the people who really stand out to us in this pro C or big C group is the way in which they give themselves permission to marry authenticity with skill. And that's an act of permission, not one of intellect.
So I want to talk more about this authenticity thing. We're all raised to believe that necessity is the mother of invention. And you say the adage isn't wrong, it's just only part of the story.
Yeah, I'm tempted to say it may actually be wrong, even though I allowed for in the book that it's not wrong
Okay.
because of the angry cards and letters I would get from all the t-shirts that are out there. But I believe based on the many scholars I spoke to and the many creators I talked to, that authenticity is the grandparent of invention, and necessity is a subset of that. And why do I say that? Well, There's a moment when you talk, when creators have this aha experience, that it appears that the idea is driving and not the problem that gets solved afterwards. And sometimes we re-engineer the problem and say, that's what I was going for. But a lot of times, what I think of a creator as doing is not only answering a question, but raising the question and answering it after. Can I go into the neurobiology of that for a second? What we understand is that there are a couple of networks in the brain involved in creativity. One is the logical part of our brain, the prefrontal cortex. This is the analytical part that assesses ideas. I want to set that aside because it's not the most important part. That's the intellect part. The part that is so fascinating to me is the subconscious part, sometimes thought of as a default network, but it's the part running in the back of your brain. It's the part that calls to you when you're on the jog or in the shower or when you just woke up. And an idea hits you, and you absolutely were not focused on that idea. I'm going to cite a couple of examples, two examples, and a bit of science to back up what I mean. Is that okay?
Sure.
So I believe it was Edison and Salvador Dali who both had this odd practice. They would take a nap with a heavy object in their hand. And when they woke, when they started to fall asleep, the object would drop from their hand and they'd wake up, and sometimes they were hit with an idea. That a researcher refers to that as the hypnagogic state between sleep and wakefulness. And this researcher talks about the value of mind wandering, non-judgmental mind wandering, or the moment between kind of sleepiness and wakefulness as when ideas emerge. There's a study that this researcher participated in where they took creative physicists and creative musicians and artists and asked them to write down what they were doing when an aha moment hit. And believe it or not, Chris, 20% of the time that a big idea hit, they describe doing something mundane, unrelated to the subject that the aha moment was related to. And the researcher said to me, "How many times can you be the best at something when you're not even trying?" And 20% of the time, that's true of these great creators not thinking about what they're doing. And so what I'm getting at is this subconscious part of the brain is generating the ideas that then get run over the analytical part of the brain.
Matt, to this study that found about 20% of ideas come during times when minds are just wandering, it presents a bit of a conundrum, doesn't it? We might get a great idea when we're not thinking directly about the thing we want to have a great idea about. Can we set ourselves up for productive mind wandering, or does that defeat the purpose?
Yeah, we can, and the trouble is that it's scary. And what the research on mind wandering shows is that people do not like to let their mind wander. They often turn to worry or feel they are being unproductive. And I have, Chris, I have a little exercise for us to do. So if this question feels uncomfortable, I'll give you an example so you don't feel uncomfortable. But do you ever have sort of fantasies before you go to bed, stories you tell yourself that help you relax?
Yeah, I guess so. Or I imagine myself in a particular place. Sure.
Are you comfortable sharing any of that?
Yes, I imagine myself. I took a trip once to the Gulf of Mexico. I was in Cancun, and I imagine how peaceful it was floating in the middle of the Gulf, feeling like I had not a care in the world.
And do you ever, does that ever go any place? Do you wind up floating, I don't know, in the direction of the sunset, or does a fish jump into your boat?
Usually I'm actually floating myself in the water, and sure, I've imagined what if I washed up on a pl in a place that I didn't imagine before. Yeah.
Fantastic. Okay. Now, that may sound like nothing at all. but I want to tell you that's how books start. You have just begun a story. And what's interesting about the moment before bed, and the reason I bring up this exercise, is it's one of the few times people seem to be able to let their minds wander without judgment and go wherever your mind might go. It doesn't seem like a time, Chris, when you need to be thinking about something else or even should. Is that a fair way to think about that?
Absolutely.
So sometimes when I'm coaching young writers or something and they're like, I don't know where my imagination comes from, I remind them that there actually are lots of times when they do such a thing. To put yourself in that mindset, Chris, in a more active way, which is your question, how do we get into that place? It involves allowing yourself, giving yourself permission to float around with your perspective and your emotions without as much judgment. And I'll give you an extreme example to illustrate the other side of the equation. Do you remember the book Lolita?
Nabokov, yeah.
You know, Nabokov, what was that about?
I haven't read it. I only know from hearing stories it's about an adult man who has a sexual relationship with like a 12 or 14-year-old girl.
Okay. Now, everybody felt a little shiver of disgust or something.
Yes.
That book is considered one of the great pieces of literature of all time. Nabokov had to think that idea and allow that into his brain. I am not suggesting that that particular thought is a good one or not a good one. What I'm suggesting is that if you think about all the different ideas that might flow through someone's head that run a gamut from, let's call that a more noxious one. But maybe it's the idea for an app that someone developed. Maybe it's an idea for a song. Maybe it's a recipe. Maybe it's a new business startup. There's on a spectrum, Chris. Those can all feel uncomfortable for a variety of different ways. And let's leave out the ones that feel amoral for a second. If you look at the creativity research, people will say explicitly, I love the idea of creativity. I love it. But if you look at subconscious bias tests given to people who think about creativity, so you know, subconscious bias tests, Chris, like what's used to see how people feel about different ethnicities and races, despite what they say explicitly.
Sure.
Okay, everybody knows that. Well, these researchers applied it to creativity, and what they found is subconsciously, people associate creativity with toxins and vomit and poison.
Wow.
Right? Like, what? Yeah, I know. When I heard that, I was like, that study's going early in the book. If I can write toxins in a creativity book, that's chocolate and peanut butter. And when I talk to the researchers about why that is, it's because creativity, the ideas and actual creativity means rubbing up against boundaries that we have. It can involve change in how we do things. And if you play it out even further, Chris, it can lead to even destruction and death. What do I mean by that? Well, let's look at the electric car, hailed as an incredible innovation. May not feel so good if you're in Detroit working on a gas-powered car or in Pennsylvania working in the coal industry. Here, I make no partisan judgment, no political thing. I only mean to say that creativity is highly disruptive. It's disruptive to your moral code. In a case of Nabokov, and it's disruptive even in the case of great innovations to things we hold dear.
Hi, I'm Alan Wong, and I make podcasts at KERA. Public radio allows listeners to learn every day and approach decisions with facts and neighbors with empathy. But this vital service is only possible thanks to the community that invests in it. There's real power in having access to these conversations and stories. Invest in them today at kera.org and ensure the member campaign's success. Thanks.
Okay, so we have to get over our fear of disruption. We have to get over our perfectionism and our judgment of ourselves. I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit here. You earn your living as a writer, not a musician, but you went ahead and wrote a song to accompany this book. I want to play a little bit of that here.
Chris, let's...
We want to hear it.
Man in the dust, lonely and bruised. Penniless dreamer with no clue. How'd I get the girl who inspires a feeling inside him like fire? Her name is Helen from Troy. He's loved her since he was a boy. One day a vision, a glory, it pulls him from the dust. He tells a story. From darkness he sees, unharnessed, his odysseys, dodging sirens in the night. Gunslingers to the left, thugs to the right. Hold me now, I'm shaken from monsters of my own making.
Matt, very nicely done. I will say you set yourself up with a pretty world-class backup band. Tell us the story of this song for you.
I will, but can I just share the range of emotions right now because it's relevant?
Yeah.
There's a lot. There's gratitude. There is some shame. There's a conflicted feeling about whether anybody will like that thing, and a hope that they might, and a fear that it's now not nearly as good as I felt when I started to create it. So I just want to own all that stuff because it's relevant to this. But over time, I wrote a bunch of songs. I clearly do not have the best voice. I went and found some people to play with. And this is what's interesting about that. That song is about the birth of, it's about Homer writing the Odyssey inspired by Helen's voice. I wanted to write a song about creativity. This is what's interesting about that experience. No matter how it turned out, Chris, when the idea for the song hit, as is the case with books I've written and the stack of songs I'm looking at now, I am hit by an inspiration so powerful that I believe in that moment this thing must exist. And I think it has a raison d'etre, and I am overtaken by it.
Matt, everybody thinks of the arts as inherently creative. I think people are waking up to recognize the creativity required for a lot of science. We don't necessarily imagine any value being placed on creativity in an organization like the U.S. military. So I have to tell you, General Walter Piot's appearance in this book might take people by surprise. Tell us his story.
Oh man, I love the general. His way of thinking is so captivating, and for the reason you said, I happened to meet the general a few years ago when I was doing a story on mindfulness in the military. And this is a guy who's way up in the military, and I don't know if you have in front. He has a job at the Pentagon, like, you know, you need to have the ultimate clearance for. He was a commander of huge forces in the Middle East. And his soldiers would call him General Moonbeam because he would go and meditate and breathe and do mindfulness, say, before he'd go and meet with a commander of, you know, I hesitate to say enemy militia, but someone the U.S. was trying to work with in the Middle East. He would, before he'd got on a helicopter ride to go into a difficult situation, he would do deep breathing. And he would also write poetry, Chris. And he started to tell me about how he would use mindfulness and allowing an authenticity to allow peace to be the driving force in how he approached his military operations and his outcomes. And I started to look into the science behind this and met a woman named Emma Sapala, who's a researcher, I think, at Stanford and Yale, and really has appointments at maybe even more places. She's such a big shot. And can I segue into the science here for a second? Okay, so Emma started to look, connecting this war and peace and creativity. She started to look at people coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq and work with them to do breathing and mind wandering techniques to get them over PTSD. Now, what is PTSD? In very brief, for these soldiers, they would hear a car door slam and they would dive under the table because they thought it was a bomb. Is that a fair generic explanation?
As far as I know, yes.
Okay, all right. I just don't want to oversimplify it, but that's thank you for semi-backing me up, Chris. That's what I deserve. She would take these people and give them breathing exercises because they had an imagined fear. I mean, it was a real fear, but it was playing out in parts of their lives where there was no actual bomb. And then she started to tie that to creativity research and determined that what happens if you use some of these breathing and mindfulness exercises is it can get you past the fear, the implicit fear that you're taking a risk when you are creating, that people will judge you when you're creating, that there is an external voice that should dominate rather than your authentic internal one. And so she can tie the getting over PTSD to getting over fear of creating.
I want to go back to that fourth grade slump that I talked about in my introduction and which appears early in your book. I don't know a school teacher anywhere who says that they are not interested in helping kids be creative as well as, you know, learning the material. What exactly happens that makes the fourth grade slump take place? Because students aren't only responding to their peers, they're responding to their teachers, right?
And their parents. So you, I, it, in your introduction, didn't you mention something about don't pick your nose? Okay. Here, let me add some others. See if these resonate either if you're a parent, but you were certainly a kid. Don't run in the street. That one. Stay on your side of the back seat. Give me a couple of. You got any others that come to mind?
Don't play with matches.
Don't play with matches. And I'll add to. Don't pick your nose. Don't pick your nose and eat it. So, you know, as parents and as teachers, and I'll come to teachers in a second, but just as parents, we instill in our kids a whole bunch of rules for very good reason. Mostly, don't die. And then a variety of other reasons. But at some point, what that adds up to for kids is the impulse to say no before yes. Why should I? It's not why should I do something? Why should I have that crazy idea? It's what thing would prevent me from doing that idea? And in school, you get reinforced in that, especially, you know, when you think about a testing regime or a more rigid regime. You get told these are the rules. They need to be checked off before you do anything else. Well, these researchers in the late 50s and early 60s began to measure creativity in young people. And they determined that the idea generation appeared to go down in kids after fourth grade. And this seemed mind-boggling. Why would that be? That research and others since seems to bear out the idea that this is when kids start to internalize the no before yes. And so the secret here, Chris, is to teach rules while giving permission to play outside of them.
So, what does that look like for parents?
The answer is that there actually is a wide berth to do both. Obviously, you're not going to raise kids who think it's okay to go in the street. The picking the nose thing is a little tricky. I've done a book about the immune system that actually raises questions about that. So let's set it aside. Stay on your side of the back seat is probably pretty good because you don't want the kids fighting. But where there's a lot of room is the expression of ideas and the asking of questions that oftentimes unnecessarily rankle or bother parents and teachers. Do you ever hear this phrase, Chris? You'll hear maybe a parent say, "No, now we don't say things like that, do we, Johnny?" Does that phrase has become like fingers on a chalkboard to me, Chris, because what that kind of rhetoric does is when constantly done is begins to suggest to a kid that there's always a right way to think and always a wrong way to think. And it was interesting. One of the things that's really stuck with me that a researcher in this field said to me is a lot of times parents don't want their kids to say something. We're not talking about doing something dangerous, but even say something provocative because the parents feel it is a reflection on them and a source even of humiliation. And to the extent parents feel that way, they begin to clamp down on the ability of the young people to think outside of those areas. And that's where there's a wide berth. I have in the book some exercises that parents and teachers can do. I won't belabor them here, but there are ways to foster creativity without, causing your kid to run into traffic.
Matt, why is it worth the effort to lead a creative life, even for those of us who will maybe never achieve the big C or even the pro C that you talked about earlier?
Well, there's the one simple reason is happiness. And another misconception I think that you find with the creative narrative is that I mentioned misanthrope, but the unhappy creator, I think really misreads the research. My favorite stuff on this would suggest that people who create, who share of themselves authentically, and that can be in a million ways. In this book, I talk about app creators, and it's not just music and art. But when people share of themselves, interestingly, they feel less burdened. And they feel almost as if they're sharing their secrets with the world, even if they're not, the thing they're creating isn't about their secrets. And there's also research about the legacy people feel they've left when they've done something creative. So I would suggest to you that this is a path to satisfaction. And I would also suggest to you that the creative process itself feels very good if you allow yourself to do it. Where people get, I think, unhappy is where their expectations get set up. Look, you played a song of mine today that exceeds my expectations, but if I think I'm going to get a record contract, I'm sorely mistaken. So if I can calibrate my expectations correctly, that was a pretty fun project to do. If I base it on the outcome, I got a problem on my hands.
You're happier since you found your creative voice?
Oh my gosh. And if people want to hear about me being unhappy, there's a chapter in how I discovered it. I am so much happier and I am so grateful you had me on. I hope for people, this is a book about hope, and I know it's against the grain to do a hopeful book these days, but I hope some people find that joy as well.
Matt Rechtel is a science reporter for the New York Times, and his newest book is Inspired: Understanding Creativity, A Journey Through Art, Science, and the Soul. Matt, thanks so much for making this time to talk.
Thank you so much, Chris. That was a blast.
You can like our page on Facebook. On Twitter, we are at KERA Think, and we hope that you'll subscribe to the Think podcast by searching for KERA Think wherever you get your podcasts. You can also check out our website and listen there. That's think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.